all, and welcome to episode 42 of the Pure Tokyo Scope podcast. I am Patrick Macias, the author of Tokyo Scope, the Japanese cult film companion.
And I'm Matt Ault, the author of Pure Invention, How Japan Made the Modern World. Welcome, Patrick and me. How are we today?
We're doing okay. Like I said, it's episode 42, so this is the episode where we talk about the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything.
I remember 42. It was many, many years ago for me. I can't believe our little baby of a podcast has made it this far. We've nurtured it. It's like a Tamagotchi, you know? We've grown it to this stage.
Well, speaking of Tamagotchi and video game-related products, did you see the Mario movie? Did you actually put your money down?
I did. I wasn't 100% in my right mind when I saw it because Andy was passing around a bottle of Jim Beam in the theater.
Is this the children's matinee that you guys were seeing?
It was the Gaijin's matinee. We actually saw it in the Toho Kabukicho Godzilla Theater, as it's commonly known. I didn't take a survey, but we were surrounded by foreign people. I don't think there were any Japanese people in the audience. There were no Japanese people involved in making the film either, so perhaps this was a fitting sort of situation. But yes, I saw it. It was me and Andy, so we're two grown man children. Did you see it?
I did see it. I saw it with a child in IMAX 3D. I almost felt like I was watching a commercial for Nintendo a little bit, you know?
It felt like I was watching a video game. Actually, it didn't feel like I was watching a video game. I'm going to be brutally honest, okay? And I don't want to be the bad guy here because, like, crapping on this movie feels like kicking one of the Paw Patrol members. I mean, the movie isn't made for us, right? It's made for little kids. And I can't say that I saw any little kids reacting to it at midnight in Kabukicho in the movie theater, but there were a lot of, you know, people younger than my decrepit self were reacting very positively to the movie. So, and I wasn't negative. I was just like, wow, bombastic. Wow, more bombast. You know, it was just like a constant ramping up of like action and explosions. And then all of a sudden Jack Black sings a song and then no.
I saw it with a little kid and she liked it. Although we both kind of agreed that we liked Sonic 1 and 2 better. These Illumination movies are like, they're amusing. There's something like amusing happens every 10 seconds, but nothing funny happens. Like no like belly laughs. And if there's one thing Jim Carrey is good for, it's like the occasional guffaw, right?
I mean, this was a dense film, like, which sounds really strange to say about a kid's movie, but I mean, it's dense. There's like so much going on in every frame. The plot doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I was interested in a couple. So the whole thing is animated in France by Illumination, who you know from our favorite films, the Minions movies. and it looks like it. Like it's interesting because Mario as a character and Super Mario Brothers as that kind of franchise of games is one of those kind of culturally odorless properties out of Japan, kind of like Hello Kitty. You can't really, like, there's nothing identifiably Japanese about the storyline or the characters or anything, with one exception, which is like that the characters look kawaii. They're like kind of big bobbleheaded and whatever. This did not look kawaii to me on the screen. It looked like very Western cute, like kind of like in between Pixar and Illumination level cute, you know? It's like their house style, I guess.
But we'll come back to the movies in a little bit because that's kind of part of the news here, but maybe we should start trucking on to the news segment here.
Let's do it.
Our first item for the news segment comes from Japan Today, and the headline is Anime Luminary Maruyama Warns Japan's Top Spot at Risk.
Japan's powerhouse anime business risks being overtaken by rising Chinese competition because a tilt towards commercialism has stifled creativity, industry heavyweight Masao Maruyama has warned. In Japan, people are no longer trained in animation, he told AFP in an interview. The only reason China hasn't quite caught up with Japan yet is because of a bunch of restrictions imposed on free expression there. If more freedom is unleashed, Japan will be overtaken in no time.
Oh my God. Where do you even begin with this? You know, he's right. I mean, the Japanese anime industry has been really hollowing out. Like they've outsourced so much stuff. They don't have a lot of like the kind of traditional in-betweeners and stuff like that who are, you know, traditionally where like the directorial class comes from. So there is like kind of a brain drain. He's right there.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. Like I feel like half the people on my Twitter feed are like Gaijin who are like, hey, did anyone see One Piece this week? I animated this sequence.
Right. But, you know, okay, but this is like if China suddenly starts allowing free expression, I mean, okay, yes, if this authoritarian regime just suddenly decides we love democracy and freedom of express, if China decided to, like, you know, become a democracy, that would be a much bigger deal than the anime industry, I think. That would be like a massive global happening, you know? And it's just kind of funny. It's like, oh man, anime industry, if only China allowed free expression, they'd be beating us. I have a feeling this was taken kind of out of context because it's such a strange thing to say. I kind of want to go back to the original and see what he said here.
Yeah, I've been hearing this China's going to take over anime for like 20 years now, ever since I was like working at Viz. And like, aside from like one or two productions, it hasn't really happened yet. I mean, I think the thing that's really going to like flip the script on the industry and how things are made is probably going to be AI.
I wonder. I mean, I think Korea is in a much better, you know, place to overtake Japan anime wise, in the sense of like they have a fully developed, you know, pipeline and freedom of expression, which is pretty useful for, you know, making engaging entertainment. You know, they have music. Like, imagine like anime set to K-pop. It seems like such a no-brainer, but I guess nobody's really, you know, done that before. And also, so much stuff is outsourced to Korea, right? Like, huge amounts of Japanese in-betweening. And just for people who are just tuning in-betweening in the anime world or any animation world, the way animation works is somebody draws what are called the keyframes. And then that's like, that's kind of like the star animator of the series. And then kind of lower people, which isn't to denigrate them or anything. I mean, this is a very important job. Draw all of the many, 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 many tens and hundreds and thousands of illustrations that are needed to connect these key frames of animation. And that's kind of grunt work, and it takes a huge amount of time. And in-betweening has been hugely outsourced to other, you know, countries and stuff where it's cheaper to do that kind of thing, meaning Japan doesn't have the talent. But you're right. Maybe AI is going to start filling in those blanks. I don't know.
I mean, they're already using AI to do background art and stuff like on Netflix anime shows. And there's been some pushback, but I think it's just, there's just too much time and money to save by going in that direction. But in the meantime, I think whoever has the most money can buy as much anime as they want. I mean, look at all the foreign IP that gets anime, like Blade Runner or like Star Wars. I mean, so we don't deserve anime if it's all going to be Japanese, but Western IP.
That's a story as old as time, Patrick. Because remember in the 80s, that's exactly what happened with Transformers the movie. Like Hasbro, Sunbow, whatever the heck that production company was called, swoops in with massive amounts of cash, the likes of which Japanese animators had never seen before, and thus resulted that incredible, like, it's a terrible story, but it's an amazing movie. We've talked about this before. If you're listening to this and haven't watched at least the intro of Transformers the movie, this is the other interesting thing. Without that influx of Western cash to animate all of those Saturday morning cartoons that we grew up on, you wouldn't have the OVA boom, because the Japanese were basically with one hand taking the money from, like, you know, Hasbro or whoever to animate My Little Pony, and then pumping that money into their own, like, you know, weird, whatever it was, OVA Dalos, you know. Like,
kind of creator-driven dream projects.
Yes, and there were a million of them in that kind of 80s time frame. That was the OVA boom is as evolutionary and revolutionary for Japanese anime as, like, the rise of adult fans and stuff like that in the 70s with Yamato and Gundam and all of that.
I mean,
I don't see it happening that way now, though. Like, the Netflix money doesn't seem to be trickling into weird auteur productions. Do you get that sense?
Well, the thing I was going to say about creator-driven properties is that, like, even though people aren't making them, pretty much every anime studio or, like, top creative has one. They all have, like, these decks of their dream projects, things they've been sitting on for, like, you know, 10 plus years, but they always have problems getting those things financed, always have problems pushing those things through the gate because they're too busy making Blade Runner anime or too busy making Star Wars anime.
And that's where the money is. You know, Universal or whoever the heck owns the properties for these things dumps, you know, a ton of cash. You have to keep the lights on. Do you know what I mean? It's like you have to keep your studio running, you know? So taking on these big, high profile, high budget, relatively speaking, I don't think it's very high for the Western companies putting the money into it. You know, projects, it's really important. I get it, you know, but again, unlike in the 80s, I'm not seeing the kind of pivot where this, you know, cash flow is really sparking anything hugely new. I don't feel like a lot of amazing novelty in the anime industry at the moment. It's all like, you know, Makoto Shinkai is great, but he seems to kind of be making the same sort of film over and over again. Ghibli's out of the picture, and we just don't have a direct-to-video market anymore. I don't see anybody releasing stuff directly to YouTube, do you?
Nope. But a few words about Masao Maruyama, who gave this quote. He's one of the founders of Studio Madhouse, and then he established Studio MAPPA. As far as, like, people who's shepherded these weird creator-led projects, like, he's been really good at that sort of thing. Like, he produced Satoshi Kon's films, Hosoda's The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, and In This Corner of the World, which all kind of like kind of broke new ground, I think, in terms of like establishing new voices in anime. And now he's involved in this new kind of African anime called Mfinda. Am I pronouncing that correctly? And I'm supposed to actually talk to Maruyama at some point in the near future about this. So I'll ask him what he thinks about AI. And I'll ask him, most importantly, about his most important work that he produced back in the day, Lensman.
Well, was he the producer on that?
He was one of the producers on Lensman when he was at Madhouse, yeah.
So he knows the lens? He knows the power of the lens?
Yeah, I'll ask him, like, where's my 4K Blu-ray of the Lensman movie? I think that's the only question that's really worth asking him after this whole time.
Well, it's actually odd that there isn't one, given that that was a pretty high-profile release in the States back when anime was Japanimation, right? Like, I remember that actually was in the theaters briefly.
Do you know who was one of the producers on the Lensman movie in the U.S.?
Who?
A guy named Frank Agrama, which takes us to our second news item of the week, which is R.I.P. Frank Agrama, chairman of Harmony Gold USA.
How many times did I see that dude's name pop up on my TV when I was a teenager watching Robotech? How many times?
Yeah, it says here, April 26, Frank Agrama, founder and chairman of Harmony Gold, passed away peacefully at his home with his family. He was 93 years old. So he was the founder and CEO of Harmony Gold, the home of Robotech.
Yeah, so he is, I guess it was founded in 1983. So was it actually founded for Robotech?
No, it was founded to release this miniseries called Shaka Zulu.
Oh, right.
I remember it being heavily promoted on TV back in the day on syndicated television. And that didn't do so well for them. But the second thing they released a few years later was Robotech, which kind of like, you know, kind of kicked open the door, not only for these guys and like all kind of the Robotech licenses and toys they were doing, but also they began releasing more anime, such as like the Lensman movie and Robotech the movie. And it became less about Harmony Gold and became like the Robotech company.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what their number one associated with now. And I remember they would put out those like Art of Robotech books, you know, and then there was that whole thing about they were going to make Robotech 2, The Sentinels. Remember that whole thing, which doesn't have anything to do with the original content that it's based on. They played this incredible role with this really, at this time, it was like everybody hated Japan at that time. Okay, it was the middle of Japan bashing. So bringing Japanese entertainment to the masses really required threading some pretty incredible needles, which they did. I'm not like, looking back on it, I'm not really a huge fan of the kind of, well, let's rewrite everything and give them Western names like they did. But that's what you had to do back in the 80s to get stuff on the air. And pioneering, very pioneering. Where would we be without Robotech and that soaring theme song by Opio, what's his name? Opio Minucci or something like that? Is that his name? Robotech to the rescue. Actually, that's a different theme song.
There's so many great songs I associate with Robotech. There's The Women of Robotech.
The Women of Robotech.
Min Mei, Robotech beauty queen and singing star, leads a glamorous life.
Presenting Min Mei!
After the show, Min Mei and pilot Rick Hunter take a ride in the fanliner jet. Then it's off to dinner at the Chinese restaurant.
Oh, Rick, I'm having so much fun.
Dolls sold separately as shown. Other outfits and accessories also sold separately. New from Matchbox.
What is it about Robotech that made people want to break into song? I'm not entirely sure what it was.
That's the Women of Robotech is, I don't know what percentage of my brain is actually taken up by the Women of Robotech. Like at any given moment, I'm probably daydreaming about, you know, one of the bridge girls or like, you know, I don't know.
So I think the way this worked was that Agrama was kind of the money guy, kind of the business guy. And Carl Masek, who did kind of the adaptation of the original anime series into Robotech, was kind of the guy who went to the cons. But speaking of cons, Agrama was convicted of tax fraud and embezzlement several times. There was kind of a tragic side to the story where he kind of kept getting into money problems.
This is pretty brutal. I'm reading the Wikipedia page right now. Italian investigators discovered and froze bank accounts in Switzerland. Okay, according to one Italian daily, the five accounts are said to contain $109.5 million, the U.S. equivalent. Wow.
Yeah, this is some Bond supervillain stuff, definitely.
All off of Robotech? That's amazing. It just goes to show you how big it was, you know? And it also goes to explain why Harmony Gold basically only does this. It's just Robotech all the time.
There's a really sinister postscript to his obituary that Harmony Gold posted online, and it says...
Really?
Yeah. Sony Pictures is set to produce a full-length Robotech live-action feature with Mark Canton and Gianni Nunari producing. So we have that to look forward to at our local Toho cinemas.
Well, you know, Super Mario made $1 billion, so why can't Robotech?
Oh, yeah, and Barbie is probably probably going to make $1 billion next.
Barbie will definitely make it. Now, like, you know, the billion is the new million, I think. It's like if your movie based off 80s IP doesn't make $1 billion, you know, you ain't got game, as they say.
Well, it helps if they keep rising the ticket prices. That way you can count more loot cakes on the table at the end of the day. Speaking of the movies, Matt, next month, Toho Cinemas will be raising ticket prices. Toho Cinemas announced on the 1st of June that would raise movie ticket prices. General admission will now be 2,000 yen, which is 100 yen higher than it's usually been at 1,900 yen. This is due to soaring energy prices, rising purchasing costs due to the weaker yen, increased operational costs centered on part-time labor costs, and increased burdens in various capital investments. Ouch. That hurts, man. That's like being thrown down a flight of stairs.
Is this what they meant by protoculture in Robotech? I don't know. I go to movie theaters so infrequently these days that I actually couldn't even tell you what a movie ticket price goes. Like, I just pay it. I'm at the box office. I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, forking over the money. So I think that probably the theaters are banking on this, that a lot of people don't really even have a sense of what a movie ticket goes for these days.
So 2,000 yen is about $14.79 in USD. But I think like the 2,000 yen mark was some kind of like, you know, psychological barrier that hadn't been punctured yet, because all of my like cranky middle-aged otaku friends on Facebook are like, that's too much, man. I never thought I would see this in my lifetime.
1,900 yen is fine, but 2,000?
Fuck Hollywood. Burn, Hollywood, burn.
Sneak into the movies. I'm sneaking in from now on. Is it true there's like, if you climb in through Godzilla's mouth, there's like an emergency slide that like deposits you right into the theater during a showing of some film? I'd like to. Kids, don't try this at home. I'm just kidding. You know, now that Corona is apparently officially done, I guess we can, you know, people are going to start flooding back into the movie theaters. So this is just the perfect time to jack up prices.
It's just general inflation. But yeah, for some reason, like all my otaku movie buddies are like seriously pissed off.
Well, what's a ticket go for in the States?
Average movie ticket costs about $11.75 in 2022.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, wow. Japan expensive by more $3 more. Actually, it's funny. There's a New York Times article about this exact same thing. Movie tickets are getting more and more expensive in the States too. I guess it's tough. You know, I personally prefer to wait and watch things streaming. It's very rare that a movie comes along that I feel the absolute need to see in the theater. You know, it's not a Shin Kamen Rider film. Like I have to watch it at home. I don't know.
Yeah. But Matt, the Barbie movie, come on.
We're going. You, me, and our friend Jack Daniels, we're all going to see the film together.
In cosplay? No, wait, we should go as the women of Robotech. Like an invading army kind of take over the theater as like rival dolls from Matchbox, not Mattel.
I'm Shemmy. I'm the Shemmy and you're the Shempai. We're the best newscasters ever. I just want to mention that right now. We're really good at our jobs. This is why they pay us the big bucks. Okay, Patrick, I have a big story, a huge breaking story. It turns out, okay, that one of the biggest Pokemon trading card stores in Akihabara is now going to begin carding people who show up to make sure not that they're too young, but that not that they're too old. They're only going to sell Pokemon cards to people who are junior high school age and younger, hoping to cut back on the spate of scalping that's been happening in the Japanese card collecting world. How do you feel, Patrick?
Imagine getting carded so you can buy Pokemon cards, dude. I don't want to grow up. I'm a Pokemon kid. I don't know, man. But there's also been like a bunch of robberies in Tokyo of Pokemon card shops recently.
Yes.
Maybe these kids will be packing heat.
The Pokemon and all sorts of collectible card shops sprung up like mushrooms on rotting material during the pandemic. I think the only kind of shop there's more of than collectible card shops now is Rolex stores in Nakano Broadway. What percentage of Nakano Broadway is Rolex stores now? I'm not exactly sure. Are they going to start carding you to make sure that you're not like 90 years old when you buy a Rolex there?
We're going to have to disguise ourselves so we look like little kids. Or maybe we can ask a little kid to buy them for us.
Exactly. It's like the reverse. What's the adult version of being like three kids in a trench coat? We have to, like, you can be like Dorf. You can walk in with like, you know, your shoes on your knees. You have to have like a pacifier in your mouth.
We can make a deal like, I'll buy you liquor if you buy me Pokemon cards.
Exactly. one vice for another. I love it. Because this is a tough one. Like, it's probably easier for a kid to fake being like looking like they're older than they are than it is for somebody who's like 50 years old to look like they're a junior high schooler. Anyway, I'm actually all for anything that cuts down on scalping. I like the fact that, you know, Pokemon cards are going to actual children who are enjoying them as part of their childhood.
And on that note, we'll cut to a commercial and come back with our feature attraction.
Once in a generation, there comes a show that defines an era. A show that celebrates what it means to be alive. A show about people getting smacked in the face. Contestants risk everything to storm a castle for no reason whatsoever. What more could you possibly want from your television? It's bigger. It's better. It's back. Join me, Jonathan Ross, for brand new Takeshi's Castle, coming soon. Only on Comedy Central.
Well, Matt, there's a certain Japanese filmmaker that's been on my mind recently because it seems like, I wouldn't call it a comeback, he's been here for years, but Takeshi Kitano, aka Beat Takeshi, has a lot of things on the horizon right now. He's back with Takeshi's Castle.
Yes.
Amazon yes. series, kind of a sequel to his legendary game show from the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
And there's also a new film that Kitano has written and directed called Kubi, which is set to premiere at Cannes later this month. And it's kind of a historical drama, like a Jidaigeki in the grand old Akira Kurosawa tradition. So there's a lot of Beat Takeshi energy out there in the universe right now.
I was going to say, Kubi looks really interesting to me. I really liked his last outing set in the medieval period, which was Zatoichi. And actually, I don't know if that's the medieval period. That's more of the Edo period. But I have high hopes for this. Kubi means like head, like a decapitated head in Japanese. And it looks like from the preview that there's going to be a lot of just that in the film. Decapitation.
Recently, I came across this list. Takeshi Kitano names his 10 favorite movies of all time. And I'd never seen this before. And I thought it was kind of interesting into like kind of gives you some perspective into, you know, kind of what makes the guy tick, his influences, and what sort of dude he is. Because it's often hard to tell because what is it? He had like a motorcycle accident and half his face is paralyzed or something like that.
You know, most of the people listening to this probably know who Beat Takeshi / Takeshi Kitano, as his real name is. But he is Japan's probably best known comedian. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, he sort of branched out from being a funny man into making these brutally dark and violent Yakuza movies.
But dark humor, there is always an element of like dark comedy, even in his most brutal films.
And they're well made. Like, it's obvious this guy loves cinema. He did his homework. Like, he loves the films that he's kind of homaging. And I remember, you know, seeing his first Violent Cop. The Japanese title is Sono Otoko Kyobo Nitsuki. Like, that guy is about to get violent. That is a really amazing piece of cinematic work. Like, he casts himself as this dirty cop who is just locked in this blood feud with this insane gangster. And it plays out across, like, the city. Like, there's all sorts of, like, you know, casual a fallout of like innocent bystanders getting like maimed and killed, and it ends on a very not upbeat note. But it's like, it was shocking that a comedian made this film, and then he followed it up with a bunch of other films. Sonatine, I guess, was the second one after that.
It's like Boiling Point, Sonatine, Hanabi. He was this kind of this hot streak he had, and the way I remembered is there was some pushback from Japanese critics saying Kitano shouldn't be making these movies; he should stay in his lane and be a comedian. But it was really the kind of like rapturous reception he was getting from overseas audiences that he was getting abroad that people realized this was like a major new filmmaking talent. And I think with Violent Cop, the story was that he was only supposed to star in it, and it was Kenji Fukasaku, the director of Battle Royale and The Green Slime and Message from Space, who was going to direct, but he got sick. So Kitano took over and kind of like did his own thing with it. And that's probably my favorite Beat Takeshi movie.
It's great. But also, you know, I think we should say here that even though he was a comedian, he had been acting in serious movies. Like, he was his debut in Oshima's Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence? He plays kind of the sub-antagonist in that film.
I don't know if that was his first film starring performance, but yeah, he was already kind of going in a dramatic direction, but he wasn't actually directing stuff himself until Violent Cop. But I came across this list of Takeshi Kitano's top 10 favorite movies of all time. It appeared on combustiblecelluloid.com. I don't know how accurate this is. You know, if you find something on the internet, just automatically assume it's true. So we're going to start at number one. I don't know if these are just like 10 random movies or if they go in order, but I'm going to start with number one here with Children of Paradise, Marcel Carné, 1945. A film I've not actually seen because I'm not really a French film guy. Sorry, everyone.
I haven't seen the entire film, but there are several key scenes. It's the one of the only films I've ever even seen part of where mimes are cool. Like there's a really amazing scene with a mime and a pickpocket. That's pretty famous. That film shows up on famous directors' best of lists like across the world. So I'm not 100% surprised to see it on here. But it does show you that, you know, he's serious. He's a serious cinephile.
The next two films are both from Stanley Kubrick, 2001, A Space Odyssey and A Clockwork Orange. Again, often found commonly on lists of like great movies of all time. You can definitely see some of the mixture of dark humor and violence in Clockwork Orange. Space Odyssey is obviously a masterpiece. You know, everyone should see that in a theater at least once. I'm more of a Barry Lyndon guy as I get older with Kubrick.
Sorry, I only watch Eyes Wide Shut over and over and over again. That's the only Kubrick film as far as I'm aware of. Okay, so we have pretty like straightforward choices so far. Okay.
Okay, and number four is The Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa. And this is like maybe the ultimate standard greatest movie of all time list choice. And here it is. I mean, I kind of prefer kind of the more epic, colorful Kagemusha or Ron if I'm going to like go Kurosawa. Seven Samurai is kind of like the people's choice for like the greatest Japanese movie of all time, isn't it? Before Spirited Away came out, right?
Exactly. Before Violent Cop came out. No, you say that, but I actually think it's much more common to see that on foreign directors' best of lists. Like Kurosawa he only kind of became prominent in Japan after he was recognized abroad, I think. You know, like a lot like Ozu is kind of the same way. Like you had foreign critics and foreign directors venerating these people. And now I think that's actually kind of an unorthodox choice for a Japanese filmmaker to a certain degree. I respect it. I love that film.
Okay, moving on to five. Now Kitano starts going nuts and picking some deep cuts. And I think the theme from here on out is like the B-side wins again, where he's not choosing expected choices. He's going a little off the rails here. Okay. His fifth favorite movie of all time is To Live and Die in L.A. by William Friedkin.
Oh, wow.
And I think a lot of people, when they choose like their favorite Friedkin movie, they're going to go for like French Connection.
Sure,
Or Sorcerer. But I got to say, like To Live and Die in L.A. is a great movie. It's a red hot, nasty little kind of like heist gone wrong movie. Wang Chung does the unforgettable music. Everybody Wang Chung tonight.
Is that literally? That is not in the movie, is it?
No, it's not the movie. They did the title song, To Live and Die in L.A. But it is one of the great 80s crime movies. It has like a completely bananas car chase backwards on a freeway.
Pete Takeshi suggested it, so I'm definitely going to watch it now.
And yeah, it is really similar to something like Violent Cop or like one of those really early, nastier Pete Takeshi movies. So I can totally see why he would choose this one.
Right.
Up next is Wild at Heart by David Lynch from 1990.
Wow. Okay. Because normally Lynch appears on these and it's almost always Eraserhead.
Or Blue Velvet or Mulholland Drive. Usually, I think even hardcore David Lynch fans kind of consider Wild at Heart to be kind of like second tier Lynch.
It's a little bit of an outlier, isn't it? It's a weird film. I actually saw it in the theater. I've seen it probably most recently.
With your parents? Did you see it with your mom?
Yeah, like, exactly. And then afterwards, I'm just putting lipstick all over my face, like Laura Dern's mom's character.
It does have a crazy Nicolas Cage performance. And again, William Dafoe is back here from To Live and Die in L.A. And it's got some insane violence in it, but it always kind of grates on me, and I'd rather watch Dune if I'm going to watch a David Lynch movie.
Well, it always felt to me like David Lynch doing David Lynch as opposed to, does that make sense? Do you know what I mean? Like it felt a little forced to me in ways that his films are always contrived to a certain degree. I mean, they have to be, you know, because they're kind of like walking dreams, but that one just, I kind of left my shaking my head about it. But that's an interesting choice. It's not a bad choice. It's just an unusual choice, I think we can say.
And going in that vein, up next is Bring Me the Head Head of Alfredo Garcia by Sam Peckinpah, 1974.
Wow, that's another unusual one, isn't it? Because Peckinpah is usually, I would associate him with like one of his other kind of Western films.
Most people usually go for The Wild Bunch, or if they want to go deep, they'll go for Cross of Iron, which might be my favorite. But this is a weird Warren Oates in Mexico movie, and it's set in the modern day. It's not set like in the Old West or like World War II like his other films. This is one of my dad's favorites, so I saw this a lot as a kid. It's got crazy gun battles. It's kind of like a really messed up, dark, gritty Treasure of the Sierra Madre. But again, this kind of like uncomfortable mix of like violence and real dark comedy. I don't think there's anything intentionally funny in the movie, but you will end up laughing as Warren Oates is sort of like mumbling to the severed head of this guy he's trying to get a bounty on. He has a whole conversation with the severed head in the bag.
Oh, that's nice. That sounds like a wonderful family film.
Okay, up next is probably the wildest cut on this top 10 list, which is Darkman by Sam Raimi.
Wow, okay, I like that film. Okay, I like that film.
It's at least as good as 2001 A Space Odyssey, you have to admit. Exactly. And The Seven Samurai, Darkman, I mean, it fits right in the middle there somewhere, doesn't it? Darkman is one of my favorite movies. I gotta say, man, it was like he was preaching to the choir here. I think it's Sam Raimi's best movie. You know, it's kind of a superhero, kind of a mystery man movie, but it's really operatic, really tragic. It's a love story. It's got like Liam Neeson in the lead and Frances McDormand, and they're able to like kind of like really find the drama and the humanity in this like schlock. And if you hang out with me too long, I'm going to make you watch Darkman, even if you've seen it before. Like, I love Darkman.
Darkman, it always felt to me like it should be a double feature, like in the afternoon with like Highlander. You know what I mean? Like, it's just one of those, it's from roughly around the same time period. I don't know, maybe I saw them together in the theater. They're always linked in my mind, but that's really bold to put that on the same list as like Lynch and Kurosawa. I'm impressed. I'm like really, I'm honest to God impressed. Like, no, I was expecting you to say like, oh, Wong Kar Wai, you know, or maybe like John Woo even, you know, because I think there's a lot of Woo in Kitano's work.
Sure.
Know? But wow, Darkman. Okay.
There's no Godfather. No Godfather 2 on this list.
No Godfather. You're going straight from the depths of outer space to the depths of the human soul in this film.
Up next, Crazy Thunder Road by Sogo Ishii, 1980. This is the legendary Japanese punk rock low-budget indie movie that kind of revolutionized Japanese cinema and Japanese cinema goers who'd never really seen that kind of like punk spirit in a Japanese movie before.
Well, I mean, Sogo Ishii is like a total legend. What, God, he directed so many insane films over the years.
And it's kind of a story about like bike gangs interfighting, and it's kind of focusing on this one guy. He's kind of a loser. And at the end, he does the kind of like armed incel taxi driver thing and like suits up like in motorcycle armor and gets a shotgun and goes on a rampage, not against like normal folks, but against like the other rival gang and some right-wing nationalists, if I'm remembering this correctly. But again, like every Japanese cult movie guy of a certain age, this was like the movie for them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Sogo Ishii is the kind of guy who doesn't usually turn up on foreign people's, foreign director. I don't think his stuff got hugely distributed abroad.
No, it only came out recently, subtitled, I think, on DVD and Blu-ray, even in the West for the first time, like in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years.
He just seems like somebody who's just really marches to the beat of his own drummer, so to speak, and probably doesn't neatly slot into the industry over there. He did a short based on an Otomo Katsuhiro of Akira fame manga.
Was it called Running? I forget what it's called. I did see that as well. Run. Okay.
Run. Run was the manga, and he turned it into Shuffle, not to be confused with the Hollywood Shuffle. It's just Shuffle. But this is like 1981. That is a deep, deep, deep cut. I'm just, you know, patting myself on the back for even remembering it. I don't even know where that came from.
Sogo Ishii was 20 years old when he made Crazy Thunder Road. And I guess when he made Shuffle, he must have been like 21. So there was really no one at that age producing feature films. So he was a big inspiration to the movie guys in Japan.
Well, he has that kind of screw you, I'm going to make my own movie kind of vibe to him, which is, of course, catnip to any other director.
And last on the list is The Railroad Man, Pietro Germi from 1956. It's an Italian neo-realist drama. I've not seen this one. This and Children of the Paradise are the two on the list I've never seen.
I'm kind of getting the sense here that Takeshi Kitano is kind of throwing out a bunch of films that were on the top of his head. Because some of these are such deep cuts, I'm not sure what to make of them. And others are like so, what's the word, populist? What's the word I'm looking for? This list is all over the board, which kind of fits a guy whose own oeuvre is all over
the board. Yeah, I've not seen this one. It's about a world-weary railroad engineer and like some family drama that's going on in his house. For me, Italian film like starts with Fellini and Sergio Leone and like stuff that happened right. Beginning in the early 60s. So it's a big blank spot in my edumacation. But maybe I'll check it out. Maybe I'll check out The Railroad Man and Children of Paradise. If they're good enough for Takeshi, they're good enough for me.
Do you think either of those films influenced Takeshi Joe, Takeshi's Castle, which is really what started this whole conversation in the first place? Amazon is rebooting a dark, gritty reboot of the classic 1980s batshit crazy gonzo audience participation reality TV precursor, Takeshi's Castle, which was this amazing show where, like, I guess you had to apply to be on it, but you had to run through like an obstacle course of insane, you know, they're shooting like, you know, giant foam balls at you, or you have to run across like logs that are spinning over like mud pits and things like that.
I did not watch Takeshi's Castle back in the day, but there were always like clips being shown. Didn't it actually get shown overseas as well?
Years later, it was on cable TV in one of those like really kind of condescending localizations. I think it was called Most Painful Eliminations or something like that. And they renamed him like Vic something or another in it. But when I was a kid, I went to school in the suburbs of Maryland, and there were a lot of Japanese students in our classes because their parents, their dads generally had been kind of assigned to, you know, rotated around in their work to the States. And somebody in my grade had just tons of tapes of Japanese TV that like their family had been sending to them. And me and my friends were always borrowing them to watch like the anime that was on them. But there were also Takeshi's Castle. And I remember at one point, like my mom or my dad walked in the room while we were watching Takeshi's Castle. And they're like, what's that? And like, it kicked off this whole thing where like my parents got into Takeshi's Castle and we were like all watching it without any subtitles or anything. You don't really need them. It's like, they're literally just sending Japanese citizens into this meat grinder of like super kawaii obstacles. It was like a family bonding moment over Takeshi's Castle in the late 80s, thanks to Japanese like bootleg videotape. This is probably better spun off into its own episode, but Takeshi's Castle aired in the 80s amidst like this huge boom for Japanese crazy game shows that featured regular citizens instead of celebrities. And I really, like when I was writing Pure Invention, one of the chapters that I wanted to write but didn't have the time to do was one about reality TV, because I think like Japan really invented it. You know, now you don't see shows on Japanese TV that feature average people. It's all like these kind of B-list celebrities. Back in the 80s, it was all regular people doing crazy stuff. Like no matter how crazy it was, somebody would do it. And there were so many of them. There was Zagaman, which is this crazy show where they're literally torturing people by like pouring like hot sauce down their throats and stuff. And there was like the America Odon Quizu, like the quiz show where like they sent people to drive across the USA Cannonball Run style and answer quiz questions. It was amazing. We really should do a show on this at some point. They don't exist anymore. Like they really, like, it was, what's the line from Blade Runner? You know, your light is burned so very brightly, you know, the light that burns twice as bright burns half as long. They only had like a 3-year lifespan, just like replicants. They literally came and went. But we should totally talk about that.
I'm looking forward to Kubi. I can't wait. I'm willing to pay that extra 100 yen for my movie ticket when it opens around here. So
not me, man. I'm jumping in Godzilla's mouth and sliding in like a super robot pilot into my seat in the theater. You know, I'm sneaking in. I can't afford that 100 yen, man. I'm a poor podcaster, Patrick. Where's my salary? Where's that money you owe me for this, for all my appearances? Where's my royalties?
We have to go buy some Pokemon cards. I'm a little kid, and then put them on the resale market on Mercari and hope to pocket a few extra yen.
I'm going to get my pacifier and baby bonnet and like kind of crawl into the store and ask for some Pokemon cards. I'm underage, I promise.
Almost every Japanese child knows Pocket Monsters and its star, Pakucho. They play the Nintendo computer game. They even sing the Pocket Monsters song. Pokemon! Millions were glued to the latest cartoon episode when a flashing explosion created from these slowed down images triggered convulsions in hundreds of children. More children had fits when excerpts were replayed on the news. Doctors said victims were shocked into a kind of hypnotic trance. Parents are alarmed.
Well, Matt, that about wraps it up for episode 42. Oh my God, life, the universe, and everything. And actually, we're coming up on our first anniversary as a podcast. Can you believe it?
Wow. Wow. What a cavalcade of content we have provided to our eager audience of listeners. I'm very proud of us. We have to celebrate. I know just the restaurant to celebrate at, Patrick.
Don't say it. Don't say it. I'll have to break out the air horn. You say it at home. We want to hear you at home. Clap if you believe in fairies, okay?
And on that note, see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
It's Lisa Hayes taking command on the Robotech battleship, preparing to launch the attack.
Get ready for battle. Okay.
But when her work is done, Lisa and pilot Rick Hunter go out for an evening of fun.
Lisa, you look so beautiful.
Isn't she neat?
Dolls sold separately is shown. Other outfits and accessories also sold separately. New from Matchbox.